The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome. Delightful to see so many people this evening. My name is Dorothy Del Bueno, and I'm a proud supporter of the Free Library and a member of the Ben O'Leal Society, which recognizes those who've made a planned gift to the Free Library Foundation. Planned gifts ensure that the Free Library will be able to continue to transform lives for generations to come, which, as we all know, is especially crucial today. If you're interested in supporting the library in advancing literacy, guiding learning, inspiring curiosity, please think about making a planned gift through the Free Library Foundation. If you'd like more information, you can contact freelibrary.org/support. And I personally would endorse the charitable annuities are a wonderful investment. You do well by doing good. It's now my pleasure to introduce tonight's two authors, Alice McDermott and Lauren Grodstein. A National Book Award-winning author, Alice McDermott explores themes close to her heart: love, the loss of innocence, the interlocking stories of family and children who must grow beyond the safekeeping of their parents. The New York Times says of her new book, which is entitled Someone, "This is a book so deft that even the damp shirts and school blouses on the clotheslines have some import." That's a wonderful line, I think. Someone is a wonderfully modest title for such a fine-tuned, beautiful book filled with so much universal experience, such haunting imagery, such urgent matters of life and death. Miss McDermott is a plain-spoken, even at her most wrenching. According to the New York Times Book Review, Lauren Grodstein is a master of quiet domestic worlds and a suspense worthy of Hitchcock. Also the author of A Friend of the Family is a novel described by the Washington Post with such an incisive diagnosis of aspirational America that someone should hand out copies at Little League games and ballet recitals. A professor of creative writing at Rutgers Camden, the Post describes her new book, The Explanation for Everything, as a gripping tale of a biologist who finds himself approaching midlife and suddenly finding faith. Please join me in welcoming our first author, Lauren Grodstein.
Hi. Hi. Thanks for coming. It's such a thrill to read here. I'm so excited. I'm going to read from my new novel. It's called The Explanation for Everything, which is a title my editor thought of, and I said to her, you know, it's really a tall order. Like, I don't have... And some readers online, where readers like to complain, have said, "The explanation for everything was not in this book." So I'll tell you that now. What is in this book is the story of a biology professor who... is a Darwinist, sort of in the mold of Richard Dawkins, and he teaches an evolutionary biology course, and he's a very quiet kind of guy who believes in... He's a widower, he wants to raise his kids, wants to teach his class, wants to get tenure, wants to be left alone. And he pretty much is until an encounter with a creationist student. What I'm going to do is read the very beginning of the book, which needs no setup, and then I'm going to read just a little part of that first encounter with his creationist student. And now I'll start. One. The first time Andy met Louisa, she was covered in blood. He was a bit bloodied himself, having just suffered a minor bicycle accident where Nassau intersects with Mercer and nobody can see himself coming or going. It was a Sunday morning in 1994, and Andy was wearing the ridiculous clothing he'd let himself get talked into by that cute sales girl, purple spandex shorts and a black and silver nylon shirt. Anyway, he'd been daydreaming, yes, but he was reflexively careful at that intersection. And then an Audi out of nowhere, some cursing, an unnecessary ambulance, and now here he was, cradling what was almost certainly a broken wrist and thinking about his dissertation and the way the Mercer County emergency room smelled like urine and paint. The orange plastic chair was hard under his butt. His bicycle-friendly spandex shorts offered no padding whatsoever. Then, as CNN began to rotate through yet another story on O.J. Simpson, this girl sat down next to him, her hair trailing down her shoulders and round her face, the most magnificent sample of human hair he'd ever seen. Brown and gold streaks and some blonde in there too, curls and waves like in a magazine. The face wasn't bad either, as far as he could tell from profile. A nice curve of the cheek, a slightly oversized bumpy nose, a full mouth. But it was that hair he couldn't stop looking at. He had the absurd compulsion to stick his hands in it, and he was grateful to his probably broken wrist for stopping what would have otherwise been a sure breach of etiquette. She was not looking at him. Her left hand was wrapped in red-stained gauze, and she had blood on her white T-shirt and blood on her jeans. "What are you here for?" he asked. The question was absurd, but he felt that if he talked to her, he would almost certainly not stick his good hand in her hair, or, if he did, conversation would offer him an opportunity to first ask permission. She turned her head. The face was prettier straight on than it was in profile. Nice eyes, the shape of almonds, and irises the color of almonds, too, and the bumps in the nose receded as a matter of perspective. She had small, shell-like ears, each one rimmed with stud earrings. She smiled. "I cut myself." "Right," he said. She smiled at him again, and for the first time since the Audi, he didn't think, even obliquely, about his wrist. "How so?" "Opening a can of caviar. Isn't that ridiculous? I think I cut a cephalic vein. This will not stop bleeding." She looked down at her bandaged arm, sighed heavily. "A cephalic vein, huh?" he said. "Interesting." Here, Andy was thinking of the Latin word cephalicus and trying to show off. "Isn't that a vein in your head?" "Your arm," she said, holding out hers. It was a thin, freckled arm, finely covered with reddish-gold hairs, except for the part that was wrapped in reddening gauze. "But cephalization is the formation of neural structures in the head." He knew this from his biology training. "So that doesn't make any sense that it would be in your arm." "And yet it is." "But that doesn't make sense." Why was he fighting with her? "Are you a biologist?" She shook her head. I'm actually a nurse," she said, "in Philly." Which is too bad, because if I were in Philly, I'd probably get some kind of professional courtesy. But of course, I have to cut myself in Princeton, where nobody knows me. "And so," she said, grandly, "I wait." Was it really a can of caviar? Who would make that up? "Does it hurt?" "No worse than your wrist," she said, looking at the wrist he was cradling. Her gaze was pointed. His wrist was in his lap. Andy crossed his legs. Oh, these ridiculous bicycle shorts. "How long do you think I'm going to wait, anyway?" she asked, raising her almond-colored eyes. "I've been here since 8:30. "Christ," she said, "it's almost noon." "Is it?" Could he say to her that time stops the second he first caught sight of her and her hair? She leaned back against the chair, closed her eyes. She had long black lashes, thick, like a paintbrush. She breathed in and out deeply, as though she were a person preparing to sleep. Andy hadn't spent time with a woman with anything like regularity in months. Most of his friends in the department were male, and his professors, and even the plurality of his students. How nice it was, he thought, to talk to a woman, to this beautiful woman. "What are you doing in Princeton?" he asked, even though she gave no indication that she wanted to keep talking. "Boyfriend," she said, her eyes still closed. "Oh," Andy said. He did not feel dejected, because he had never considered himself an actual candidate to become this woman's boyfriend. The fact that she already had one could not be a deterrent from a position he had never considered occupying. How could he ever be this woman's boyfriend? The women Andy dated were severe, prone to nervous breakdowns over their studies. when they cut themselves, it was usually on purpose. Where is he now? He had to study. He's got his math orals coming up. So he just dropped you here? I know, right? She opened her eyes. It's probably time to get a new boyfriend. But before Andy could follow that tantalizing lead, what kind of new boyfriend? Where would you go looking for this new boyfriend? A woman with a clipboard appeared in the doorway to the examining room. Wait, Andrew, wait. He stood. Is she telling you to wait? The woman said. Lou asked him this. She was sitting up again, and the gauze around her wrist looked ever darker with blood, and he wanted to pick her up and carry her off to a better place, or, at the very least, give her his place in line. Instead, he said, "That's my last name. Wait." "Oh," she said. "You want my turn?" She smiled at him again gently, as though he were a fool. "You look like you're in worse shape than I am," he said in a rush. "Seriously, I'll be fine. You should take my turn. You're bleeding to death." She shook her head, and a curl of that hair fell into her face. "That's nice," she said. "Thank you, that's really nice, but you should go ahead. I'm not going to die." Andy felt himself heartened by this. This girl wasn't going to die. Louisa, he did not yet know that she was Louisa, said she wasn't going to die. And he did not yet know that he shouldn't believe her. Skip it a few pages. So finding her again after the afternoon in the emergency room turned out to be much easier than snooping around the math department. Not that Andy didn't snoop around the math department and its rose bushes, or dream up ways of stealing her ER records, or imagine combing Princeton's colonial avenues in search, Rapunzel-like, for a flash of that beautiful hair. But none of this was necessary, because 2 weeks after first crossing her emergent path, there she was in front of the record exchange, bending down to tie a shoe. He realized that since he had been expecting to see her everywhere, he wasn't surprised when he finally did. She was wearing a jacket, but a bandage peeked out from under it, enclosing her left hand. His own wrist itched madly. There she was, his girl, a fellow veteran from an imaginary war. "Hey," he said, "hey." He tried to tone down his grin, but it was impossible. He was too happy, she was too lovely, and she was standing right there. "Mr. Wait," she said, "hello." She remembered his name, and she was smiling, too. She gathered her hair back in her good hand and pushed it off her shoulders, but it immediately breezed back around her face. "I was wondering if I'd bump into you again." "Visiting your boyfriend?" he asked. "Walking to the train." "You're going to walk?" "You're going to walk?" She sighed, kicked one of the bags at her feet. "He failed his orals. He's moving to New Mexico. I'm not going with him." She looked embarrassed. "So I think that's the end of that. And therefore," she said, grandly, "I walk." "Ah," Andy said. He wanted to take this in, but again that lunatic desire to plunge his hands into the depths of her hair, and this time now to cradle her face, to kiss her. God, he was so itchy. "I'm sorry," he said. "Thanks," she said. She had a huge duffel bag and a roller suitcase, a lot of stuff. "It's probably fine. I mean, I think we'll both end up fine, and I need to spend more time in Philly anyway. I mean, it's where I'm supposed to be working." "I like Philly," he said. They grinned at each other again, stupidly. "What's your name, anyway?" "I'm Louisa," she said. "That's pretty." "It is," she said, "but you can call me Lou." And from there, it was easy. He felt, in fact, that the ease was his reward for everything that had been so hard from the beginning, escaping Ohio, finding a place at Princeton, finding a few friends, putting together a life for himself, learning to cook and clean and look after himself and live like a grown-up with no one to show him the way, to help him figure out what mattered. He walked Lou to the train, hefting her duffel bag with his good hand down the bumpy side street to the jitney. "How do I find you again, if you're not coming back to Princeton?" "You call me," she said, making it sound like an instruction. He called her. She called him back. It was that easy. They were married at the Princeton Faculty Club in front of 40 people a year later. Her parents from Arizona, his mother from Ohio. Lou promised she would nurture him. Andy promised he would take care of her for the rest of her days. They honeymooned in Paris. He wrote his dissertation in their tiny studio in Philadelphia. And once he was officially Dr. Waite, they moved to Miami for his postdoc. There, she worked 12-hour shifts in the NICU of Kendall Regional. He performed EEGs on rats. At night, in the air-conditioned haven of their moderately priced apartment in Quail Run, "Whence the quail?" she would ask. "Where do they run?" They would lie together in their bed and imagine their future children. So pretty quickly after that, Lou is pulling out of a McDonald's. She has yet to buckle her seatbelt when the local drunk kid rams into her. And from there, Andy and his two young girls move to New Jersey, where he has accepted a tenure-track job to teach in a very small biology department. And that's what he does, keeping his head down until a student named Melissa appears asking if he will take on a study of hers in intelligent design. He is appalled. He does not believe intelligent design is science, but Melissa is not only relentless and annoyingly cheerful, she's also a little bit desperate. She doesn't have a lot of money. She needs to get out of here quickly. She wants to do an independent study, and she really does want to pursue this line of thinking. So I'm going to read just a little bit from where she tries to talk him into taking on this project. "There are two ways to see the world, right?" Melissa said. "I mean, there are probably many more than two ways, but what I'm asking you here is to imagine two ways of looking at the world." "Two ways," Andy said, neither frustrated nor hurried. "Fine. There's your way," she said, "where everything is accidental, where the fact that the Earth tilts on its axis, the fact that it has a moon to control the tides, the fact that it is just the exact distance from the sun to keep us warm without boiling us alive, and even more than that, the fact that we're here, the fact that we love each other and protect each other, is all an accident of timing and chemicals." "That's my way?" "Yes," Melissa said. "That is your way, because that is the way of Darwin, which says that we are no more important, no more intentional than the dust on your desk. We might as well be like your caged rats for all the agency we have in the grand scheme of things." "All right," Andy said, neither aggravated nor impatient. "But here's your other option, a world in which life has purpose," Melissa said. "God put us here for a reason, and the reason is out in the world for us to discover. There's a reason we can see stars in the sky. There's a reason we can dig into the crust of the earth and find out what came before us. There's a reason we were given the kinds of brains that would further your scientific inquiry. There's a reason for life. There's a design behind it." Andy did not look at the clock. "I can see what you're saying, Melissa, but that's not a binary I'm comfortable with. Your world is the world of coincidence, of meaninglessness. You choose the world that would have us as specks of dust, as mice in a cage. Is that the kind of world you want to live in, Professor Waite?" Andy took a breath. "Professor?" He hated these rushes of memory, these forces that sucked him in like dark matter at the least convenient times, shattering him, but there he was, out of the shabby lab in the basement of Scientific Hall, and instead in Miami, the apartment in Miami. Four lushly carpeted and hugely air-conditioned rooms. It was night, and Lou, pregnant with Belle, was lying down next to Rachel in her big girl bed, reading Richard Scarry's best word book ever, giggling together, Louise's belly rising up and down. Specks of dust, dust to dust. Andy blinked his eyes hard. He came back to where he was. "Professor?" Melissa tried again. "Is that what you want?" "It's not," Andy said. "But I've realized over the years that what I want doesn't really matter either way." "But that's not true," Melissa said. "You get to decide what you want, and you get to decide what really matters." The chill from the air conditioning had made the hair on his arms stand up. For a moment, he lost his head. "Melissa, if you can come up with a reading list I approve of, I'll do your independent study." "Great," Melissa said. She hoisted her backpack over her shoulders and, after a smile and a sigh, galumphed out of his basement laboratory. Andy watched her go, listened to her heavy footsteps. She didn't even have the courtesy to say thanks. He returned to his drunken mice. He's doing research on alcoholism in mice. Dreaming. That's not a laugh line. That's really... He returned to his drunken mice, dreaming their placid, inebriated dreams. He reached in and scratched one on the nose. Like a bum or one of his daughters, it seemed to snort before it rolled over. Poor mice. They were the only animals whose alcoholism he was able to forgive. He knew the genetics behind it, after all. And he often found himself envying them their single-minded devotion to their drinking and their peace. Thank you.
Thank you, Lauren. That was wonderful. My husband is a neurobiologist, so I identify with much that goes on in Lauren's wonderful novel. Thank you all for being here. Thank you for missing the Sound of Music live. I will not sing Climb Every Mountain, I don't think. I'm just going to read a little bit from this new novel. It's still new. It came out in September. You know, shelf life is pretty short, but I guess it's still new till at least 2014 begins. The title of the novel, as was mentioned, is Someone. It is the story of a single woman's life, Marie Comerford, born in the early 20s, and she lives through most of the 20th century and just maybe a little bit of the 21st. She's born and raised in Brooklyn, the child of immigrants. When I was growing up on Long Island, I believed that in order to be a grandparent, you had to have an accent. Didn't matter what kind of accent it was. It could be a brogue, it could be Italian, it could be Russian, could be lots of Polish, but you had to have an accent. So Marie is in some ways that typical first generation in the early part of the 20th century. This little piece that I'm going to read is a fairly good way along in the book and somewhat along in her life. It's post-Second World War. She has married Tom, who spent some time in a German prisoner of war camp. Gabe is her older brother, who spent some time, not that there's a parallel, in the priesthood. Things just get mentioned sometimes in the same breath. That doesn't mean they're related. I think that's about all. Those are the only identifiers you really need for this section. She's a young married woman. The doctor was red-faced. His hands were abrupt. "Mrs. Comerford," he said, "you are not cooperating." Although I could not see it, I knew there must have been perspiration beaded on his forehead, because as he leaned to shout at me, a drop of it hit the sheet beneath my chin. I didn't see it fall, but somehow I heard the sound it made. And in my pain, I imagined that out of that sound, the sound of a raindrop on a dry roof, there rose more profoundly the scent of the hospital laundry. The scent of bleach on the sheet that nearly reminded me, too, of some experience in this life that I might have liked, might have loved even, my first night with Tom under sheets that had not been dried in the sun or on a line in my mother's kitchen. But the pain was a swelling black tide that engulfed the brief, bright recollection in the same way it began to absorb the doctor's red face and the hovering nurses in white and the light in the room, daylight or electric, who could say, I had been in labor for hours and hours by then, days perhaps. I had not understood, I had not been told, the extent of the suffering involved, from the cramps of the enema to the scrape of the razor to the endless searing rise and the long aching fall of each contraction. I had sent so many entreaties to heaven by then, first that my baby would be healthy, then that I would please not die, now only that the pain might end. That I had begun to see myself as some kind of fuller brush salesman knocking on a solid door, a door without hinges, without knobs. Hours, days, could it be weeks into this ordeal, I had given up the hope of getting an answer and so turned my pleas instead to my own father, who had loved me and would have wept to see me here, trussed up like a beast in a slaughterhouse, trapped under the weight of my belly, racked with pain, and now, among so many indignities, this man, this doctor, shouting angrily into my face, I am cooperating, I managed to say, and wanted to add something shocking and bitter and profane. But the black tide was surging across memory, too. I couldn't reach the words I wanted. You bastard, you son of a bitch, you Amadon, you damn fool. There was somewhere beside my ear a hiss of air. The white nurse leaned in. She held in her hand the rubber mask, offering the ether, but the doctor brushed her away with a wave of his hand. She seemed to disappear into the light. Oh, please, I heard my own voice, not roaring out those curse words as I had imagined, but pleading, whimpering, and thin. The man leaned down again. This was not my own doctor, but one I recalled brought in some time in the last few hours or days, red-faced, imperious, with abrupt, impatient hands. A little pain now, he said, for a good outcome later, for your baby. A bitter drop of his perspiration fell on my lip, and then he leaned across me, and his white chest absorbed like cotton the black wash of my pain. He was going to smother me, the only antidote, of course, for my suffering. Fool that I had been to think otherwise, no other relief but dying. Letting go of this poor body at last, sloughing it off, a shell, a doll, they could stuff it with horsehair. I would make no more entreaties. I would fall effortlessly against the solid and unyielding door. They tore me in two. Later, making a joke of it, I said I was run over by the Coney Island Express. The parameters of the pain, from breast to thigh, just about the distance between the black steel of the subway tracks. The odor of blood that filled the crowded room like the underground scent of hollowed rock and cold steel. I heard, in fact, the walloping, beating rhythm of passing subway cars just as the red-faced doctor sliced me apart without sufficient anesthesia, without any at all, I was certain, and pulled the baby out and sewed me up again so that I felt every stitch. Pain like the walloping beat, light and dark and pounding air of a passing train, steel against bitter steel, a train passing over me, cracking my hip bones and rattling the teeth in my china skull. Unnecessarily withheld, two of the nurses said later as they bathed me and changed my dressing and returned my limp body, still mine, it seemed, to a bed on the ward. They spoke softly, looking over their shoulders to the door and the hallway outside. He had his training in the army, they told me. He had a bad war. Cruel, they said of him. Brutal. They said, he thinks women need to be more stoic about these things. But when the doctor came into the room again, they only smiled and bowed and then scattered like pigeons when he shouted his demands. I saw my mother in a chair by the window when I opened my eyes again. My mother wore her hat and her pale broadcloth summer suit, and she held her purse on her lap. The slatted sunlight had washed her of all color. I thought for a moment that we might both have died during the long days and nights of my ordeal, not because of the pale light in the blank room, but because of the sweet assurance I felt, waking and seeing my mother there, that I was loved, cherished beyond all reason. The peace of this, the stillness of the room, the temporary suspension of pain seemed evidence enough that I had come to the end of time. I felt a strange elation, and then I closed my eyes and slept again. It was evening, and the light was low, and Tom was in the chair when I next opened them. And then a parched morning, the sound of trays and rolling bassinets and babies crying here and there, the sound of the nurse's voice as she leaned over me, all of it furred and fiery. I had an unshakable image of red flocked wallpaper growing like fungus over my tongue and down my throat. They threw whatever covered me aside, but there was no relief in the chill I now felt on my damp skin. The wide bandages were ripped from what was left of the poor, pale flesh suspended between the thin bones of my hips. There was the sweet, pungent odor of pus. There were barked orders from the military doctor, or perhaps this was another one. More indifferent hands running over my flesh, no indignity in it anymore. I had grown so accustomed to it now. A broad nurse with gold curls beneath her cap washed my naked body with a large sponge, running the thing up and down over my extended arm, extended because the nurse had lifted my hand and clamped it under her own armpit in the casually efficient way a busy woman hanging clothes holds a clothespin in her mouth. She ran the sponge up over my shoulders and between my breasts. The nurse wore a damp apron over her uniform, and her fat arms were as cool and solid as gray marble. There was the faint smell of vinegar in the air. Later, I heard my mother's voice raised in anger, but had no strength to assure her that there was no need to object. A body, after all, was a paltry thing, and really, Mama, all modesty, had long ago gone out the window. And then there were murmured prayers. A bald priest in a black cassock with a green and gold stole, with a missal in one hand and the other reaching for the small container my brother Gabe held out to him in his cupped palm. Gabe, too, in a pale suit, standing at the dark priest's elbow, but presiding somehow, elegant and assured nonetheless. I focused on Gabe's hands, his beautiful hands. And then I felt the flesh of the priest's thumb against my forehead and my palms. And then someone fumbled with the blanket at my feet, and I whispered, or so I was later told, "Oh, honestly." It was Tom who laughed then. I knew him by his laughter. Later, Tom put his dry lips to my cheek and held them there. "Please," he said, later still. "A beautiful boy," he said, and kissed me again. He said, "You're doing fine," and another time, "Home soon." I heard the loud-mouthed doctor say, "Built like a child to begin with," and kept my eyes closed, pretending to sleep. Then another morning, and when the doctor came in, I was sitting up in the bed and had just finished a light breakfast. He folded the blanket down to my thighs to examine my incision, but this time, with a polite caution I had not seen before, he even said, "If I may." He touched the bandages with his fingertips. It occurred to me that I had become accustomed to looking down across my body to find his head hovering there. I knew his bald spot as well as I knew Tom's. He said, "That's fine, much better," and then quickly, almost shyly, covered me again. He was, I thought, giving my body back to me. I felt a peculiar regret, the end of some intimacy. He put his hand on my forearm. He was red-faced and gray-haired and strong-jawed. He looked like an old general. Someone had told me he had had a bad war. Brutal. "Don't have any more children," he said, and then turned to the nurse in the doorway. "Bring this little mother her boy." At home, it was agreed that I would go back to my mother's apartment until I was fully recovered. My mother said, "There is the ring. There is the sheath. You can take your temperature every morning and keep a record. You can sleep in separate beds." The baby, little Tommy, was plump and healthy, alive in my arms, and he woke every 3 hours. Once again, my mother and I were sharing the big bed. My mother was up at the child's first whimper, always the warm bottle of formula at the ready. The ordeal that had almost killed me was reduced now to the hot red incision that split my belly, so jagged and roughly sewn that my mother, seeing it, had whispered, "I'd like to wring his neck." If I moved the wrong way, the pain from it would flare across my entire midsection, make me stoop to catch my breath. Tom came to the apartment after work and had dinner with us, usually with the baby in his arms, and then sat in the living room holding my hand, chatting and chatting in his cheerful way, only reluctantly lifting his hat and kissing us both goodbye when I got up to go to bed. I followed him to the door. I was still to avoid stairs. But more often than not, Gabe walked him to his car. Gabe said in the first days of this routine, he did it because Tom seemed such a lonely soul, going back alone to our apartment in Queens. But I began to suspect my brother had another intention in accompanying poor Tom down the stairs. There was the matter, after all, of the doctor's injunction. I must not have another child. When we were alone in the apartment, my mother said, "There is the ring. There was once a woman who lived on Jeralemon Street above the Shahab's Bakery who you could go to for the thing, but the right doctor could tell you as well. There is the sheath, if Tom will oblige. You can take your temperature every morning and keep a record. You can sleep in separate beds or separate rooms, and if he comes to you in the night, you can say..." She lifted her nose into the air. "And who'll raise this baby when I'm dead?" "You can sleep with a soup spoon under your pillow and give him a whack with the back of it. I don't have to tell you where." Which got us laughing like girls. My mother knew things she had never spoken of before. In the kitchen, the bustling sounds of diapers boiling, bottles roiling in the speckled pot. We were at the familiar table, my mother in her usual chair, folding the diapers she had just taken from the line. The summer heat had abated, but the window was still open. I was sitting at Gabe's end of the table to avoid the draft. I had the baby on my shoulder. The priest, to my eyes, seemed very dark in his suit, my mother said, with his little black bag, standing in the doorway and then coming toward your bed. I told Gabe to send him away. He was upset with me. He steered the man by his elbow just out into the hall, and then he came back in and said that this was something we must do for you, to assure you would get into heaven, the last rites. He was very serious. You know how he can be. A sacrament, he kept saying, as if I had forgotten. She raised her chin in some imitation of the defiance with which she had met Gabe's words. "I hadn't forgotten," she said. "I just didn't like the looks of the man coming toward your bed like that, a black-suited banshee. I was desperate with the fear that I would lose you. I said to Gabe, 'She's a young woman just after giving birth to her first child. Who's going to keep her out of heaven?' I said to him, 'How do you know she won't see him praying over her and give up the fight?' I said to him finally, 'You're a priest, aren't you? You're still a priest. Send that blackguard away and give her the blessing yourself. Didn't you do as much for your poor father?' The baby began to fuss and I stood. I rubbed my fingers up and down his spine. I hadn't known this, that it was my brother who had given my father the last sacrament. It made perfect sense, of course. Gabe was at his first parish then, but the time was a blur, and I would not have thought until now to turn my imagination to it. I said to my mother, 'I didn't know.' My mother nodded. 'It was a terrible thing to have him do,' she said, and she dropped her hands into her lap as if from sheer weariness. Terrible for him. She said, 'He was all of what, 23? Barely ordained, and your father so wasted by then, his bowels coming up to his throat, if you want to know the worst of it.' She fluttered her thin hand from her breast to her chin to illustrate, 'I did not want to know the worst of it.' Even as Gabe was putting the holy oil on him, the poor man was heaving and choking. Cruel, that cancer. Cruel of me to make Gabe go through it. I should have banned him from the room. 'I don't remember,' I said, moving to a corner of the dining room to avoid the draft from the open window. Ever vigilant now against drafts, missteps, scalding water. I was a mother now, and all the terrible things that could maul a child, snatch him from the world, had bared their teeth and trained their yellow eyes on me. The baby was warmly asleep against my shoulder. I hardly remember that time at all, I said. A blessing for you, my mother said, not to remember, and she once again touched her lips. It was my fault asking him. The poor child's hands were trembling and the tears were running down his face, and your father was choking back the black bile, trying to encourage him, trying to help him with the Latin, moving his lips like he used to do when Gabe said his poems, moving his lips because he couldn't speak. There was a terrible odor, rot and bile. The man's body wasted to nothing. Radium was what they gave him to drink. Poison, his face a skull. The dear man. I think your brother's vocation was squashed right there and then in that room, if you want to know what I think. I think it was the end of that poor boy's sweet face to see your father suffer the way he did, to see his body suffer. Here Gabe was, newly minted, full up with all the words they had given him out there at the seminary, all the prayers, and here was the sight of his father's body reduced to a whimpering, suffering thing. She paused and lifted one of the white diapers, struck it against her lap once, twice, three times, a keening gesture I had come to know. How was Gabe to go back to his parish, she said, her voice low, and stand in the pulpit and tell the people looking up at him that there was any mercy in this world? How was he to console them? She glared at me, although it hardly seemed it was me she was speaking to. Her lips were wet with her fury. His vocation ended right there in that hospital, if you ask me. I've always thought it. I've thought it for a long while. And then she suddenly looked at me directly. But don't you dare tell him I said so. I shook my head. I would not. My mother began to fold the diapers once more. So it was terrible for me to bring it up again at the hospital when that priest showed up with his black bag. Terrible of me to throw that memory in your brother's face when what he was trying to do for you was what he still hoped was right. The very best thing he knew, still, trying to assure me that you would get into heaven after all your pain. But I wouldn't be consoled. I didn't want you in heaven. I wanted you alive on earth with your child. When the priest came in again, I swung my purse at his head. Your mother did get her Irish up, was how Tom described it later in his own version of the scene. On a Saturday in cool October, 2 months after my ordeal, Tom put the bassinet and my suitcase into the trunk of the car, tying the lid half closed with rough string. He was giddy, going in and out in his good overcoat. My mother went before us down the stairs with a shopping bag full of the meals she had cooked. Gabe was behind us with the baby in his arms. Tom put one arm around my waist and gripped my right hand with the other as I leaned against the banister, taking one step at a time at his insistence. I'm really fine, I said, although the cold air and the sunlight on the sidewalk made my head swim. He eased me into the front seat of the car, only a twinge in my abdomen as I sat, an echo of the insult. Gabe leaned down to place the baby in my arms. As Tom and I pulled away from the curb, I waved to the two of them, my mother and my brother. They were standing on the sidewalk together, my mother looking very small beside him, Gabe as handsome as ever. I knew that they would watch the car round the corner, and then they would go up again together to finish out the suddenly quiet day. At the apartment in Rego Park, all was spick and span and lemon polish and the lingering odor of the apple pie Tom had taught himself to bake that morning, only the beginning of his efforts to make up for a wife who would not learn to cook. There were roses in a vase on the table in the small kitchen. The crib was ready in the single bedroom, and our bed was crisply made. He carried up the bassinet and the bottles and the shopping bag of food while I changed the baby's diaper and fed him a bottle and put him into his crib. Then Tom made tea and cut two pieces of the pie. I admired the roses while we ate at the small table. Tom told a funny story about the two ladies in the grocery store who advised him about the best apples to choose. While the baby's asleep, I told him, I might go lie down. He brought my suitcase in, and I changed out of my dress and took off my stockings and put a house coat over my slip. I put my glasses on the bedside table. He smoothed down the bedspread for me and took a throw from the closet all wordlessly so as not to wake the sleeping child. He lowered the shades while I stretched out on the bed. And when he leaned down to kiss my head and whisper sweet dreams, I took his wrist and said, "You lie down too." He walked around the bed, sat at the edge, and untied his shoes. He lay back somewhat cautiously, I thought, and with as much distance between us as there could possibly be in a double bed, reached over and took my hand. He gripped it, briefly, to assure himself that I was there, perhaps, or maybe simply to convey that he was grateful for the assurance. I heard him sigh and knew without turning my head he had closed his eyes. I lifted his hand and brought it to my lips. It was not that my life was less valuable to me now that I had glimpsed what it would be like to lose it. My love for the child asleep in the crib, the child's need for me, for my vigilance, had made my life valuable in a way that even the most abundantly offered love, my parents, my brothers, even Tom's, had failed to do. Love was required of me now, to be given, not merely to be sought and returned. My presence on earth was never more urgently needed. And yet even the certainty of that fact seemed reason to throw away caution, not to heed it. I kissed his hand and moved it to my heart. We turned to each other. "Oh, Marie," he whispered, "we have to be careful." "Why?" I asked. And I saw that he couldn't resist a smile at my answer. I was a bold piece. He made his eyes and his mouth grow serious. "You can't endure another child." "Who said?" I whispered. He shook his head. I still held his hand against my heart. "Your doctor," he said, "your brother, even the priest who came to the hospital, who gave you last rites." "Fools," I said, "which one of them has ever had a baby?" But Tom closed his eyes and put his hand to his forehead. "What a terrible night that was," he said. He whispered, "They gave you last rites," as if the memory of it still took his breath away. Gently, I touched his cheek to make him see me. I squinted in an effort to see him. "It was only the silly infection," I said, and moved closer. I felt the ache in my abdomen, the muscle closing up around the ragged scar. "Next time I'll know better," I said. "I'll bring my own ether." I began to unbutton his shirt. Everyone says the second baby's easier. Put my lips to his bared throat. Was there any place on a body more lonely and vulnerable? "A girl next time," I said. "One of the nurses told me to have a girl next time, someone to take care of me in my old age." But he was still shaking his head. "I'm not afraid," I told him. I wasn't. I had conceived our first child without any notion of the suffering involved. Now that I knew, desire, which was still there, of course, seemed small enough incentive to conceive again. It was courage now that was delightful to me. I was a bold piece. I had stood at death's door. I had withstood pain. I knew I could make a stand against it, against time, bold and stubborn, a living child in my arms. When he ran his fingertips over the scar that split my belly, he paused. I heard him catch his breath. "This is foolish of us," he whispered. I said, "I suppose it is." Thank you.
How do you talk after that? Hi, my name is Andy. I'm director of author events here, and I'm very pleased that we have these two authors here tonight. If you have a question, please raise your hand. We will get a microphone to you. Who'd like to start us off?
Well, I enjoyed both of the readings. Thank you for being here. My question's for Alice. Is that what it was like when you had a child?
Oh, no, no. I had children in the lovely days of epidurals. No, and I apologize to all the young women who have not yet been through childbirth. Times have changed. It was not that way for me, although I've heard stories.
Yeah, where did that come from? No, really, I've heard of the twilight sleep, I guess, but I've never heard of the unanesthetized C-section. But
well, I mean, ether was the drug of choice, early 50-ish. Yeah. And I had heard, and actually, not only of that era, I have heard repeated a number of times from there. I live outside of Washington, D.C., so there are a lot of retired military, and I've been told by a lot of women, you do not want a military doctor to deliver your babies. So I was able to fold that into Marie's experience.
Following up on that question, since you didn't experience it yourself, is it mostly from the stories that led you to describe a woman of a generation before you, and what prompted you to explore that generation?
Thank you. Yeah. I think the from pretty early on in composing this novel, I had a notion of a character who, coming of age through the 20th century, who probably did not have much attention paid to her. She's shy, small, a woman in a working class neighborhood. Nobody asked her opinion. She's not terribly attractive. She wears glasses at a time when people actually said men don't make passes at girls who wear glasses, and they weren't being ironic. You know, it was like advice. Or way to reconcile yourself to your disadvantage. So I just had this sense of a character who was not much heard from, but who would still have, as most of us do, an active interior life. And sort of putting that up against what I saw as a reader and a writer as a dearth of such characters in fiction. A dearth of literary fiction that gives an entire novel over to a woman's point of view. Women who write are among the best writers we've got these days in contemporary fiction. But there's not an awful lot of material that's given over to the woman's voice so thoroughly. So I knew that was risky. But because it was risky and I'm a contrarian, I thought, and you know what? And she's not going to have really anything happen. There's nothing to distinguish her from any so-called ordinary middle-class person, woman who came of age through that century. And I wanted to know what she was thinking as she experienced her life.
Lauren, can you address that too, that same question? Because it seems like in your last two books there's been a focus on the male perspective.
Yeah, I've written three novels, and all three... I've published three novels, excuse me, and all three have been from a male perspective. The first time I tried to write a novel, I was living in Brooklyn and I was in my 20s, and even then I had the sort of understanding of the world to know that it does not need one more novel by a young woman living in Brooklyn, about a young woman living in Brooklyn in her 20s. But I also, writing a novel did then and still seems to be a terrifying and almost unknowable thing. Like, I wasn't sure how to do it. Every time I tried to write, I decided I would try to write what I knew, but writing what I knew was embarrassing. So I then decided to twist what I knew and see if I could see it from someone else's point of view, and that someone else was a 20-something guy living in Brooklyn. But that small change was enough to kind of open up my imagination. And then after you write one book, it becomes a little addictive. You want to try it again. So I decided just to keep doing what I did. And so my next novel was from the perspective of a middle-aged male physician in New Jersey. So although he was also male, he was very different from me. This book was originally written in both perspectives, both the professor and his creationist student. But everyone who read the book, and eventually including me, realized that the male perspective was just much more convincing. So I try to write from a woman's perspective, and I believe completely in what Alice says, that women's lives seem to be marginalized in contemporary fiction. I'm writing my next novel now. It's the first one I've written from the POV of a woman. I'm hoping I can pull it off.
I mean, having said that, of course, we should all be free to write whatever the story demands. So it's not so much a choice that you make for political or even to advance the human race. The choices that I think that you make, who tells the story, whose story is it, what's the best voice for the story, really have to be dictated by the story itself. So that even, although I started out with this novel with some idea of giving voice to a character who hadn't been heard much, as the story progressed, if I had learned that it really was belonged to one of the male characters or needed multiple points of view, then I would have had to put that ambition aside and put myself as the writer at the service of the story, not so much to make a point. We got way too many people making points about things. We're inundated with it. And I think writers need... that's why we should be free to write from whatever perspective the story demands.
Yeah, in the second row here.
I was wondering when you started writing, and was it a compulsion? And how did you believe that you could write something that somebody else would want to read?
You mean way back in the very beginning? Well, not so far back for Lauren, but way back for me.
I was a liar, so that's sort of like being a writer. I made stories up all the time, not to get out of trouble, not to get anyone else in trouble, but just because the world seemed to need some embroidering. I lived in the New York suburbs. It was pretty ordinary. Every day was much like the other, unless you could convince people that your father was from, say, Pluto, or if, you know, so from a very young age, I liked making stuff up, and I liked the attention, and I also liked to read, and so I put the two together, and as soon as I knew how to write words, how to spell, my mother's a painter, I'd steal large pieces of her sketch paper and write stories on them. I never thought I would be a published novelist. To me, growing up thinking you'd be a published novelist was like growing up thinking you would be a rock star or president. I'm the granddaughter of dry cleaners. I was raised to be pretty practical. But I was also not very good at anything else. So I told myself I would give myself a few years to try to make something up and see if I could publish it. And if I did, I'd give myself a few more years. And if that worked, I'd get a few more years. But I knew by the time I was ancient, like by the time I was like 27, if I wasn't doing it, then I'd go to law school.
The old fail-safe of law school.
Another question? Yeah, third row there.
Oh, I think the experience is somewhat the same. I mean, I was a liar, but I didn't want anybody to know I was lying. I've made up stories. I didn't share them. I mean, I was a secret writer as soon as I knew how to write. I do think it's a kind of compulsion. I really didn't know I was a writer, although I wrote all the time. I wrote novels, you know, when I was 11 and kept diaries. And in those things, nothing actually really happened. I kept diaries hoping someone would pick it up and find out about this fascinating life that this child who was living among all these ordinary people was having. But I really did not know I was a writer until the beginning of my sophomore year in college. I went to Oswego State, one of the state universities up. Shout out to Oswego. And I took it because I love to write. I didn't know I was going to be an English major either. I went to college and became a sociology major only because sociology sounded like something you studied in college. But I love to write and I love to read. And I took a course called The Nature of Nonfiction, taught by a journalist, Dr. Paul Briand, who was also a retired Air Force colonel. And had written a biography of Amelia Earhart, Nordhoff and Hall, that's serious stuff. And our first assignment was to write an autobiographical essay. I went off and wrote this very dramatic story about these two girls in an abortion clinic. None of it had happened. I'd never been to an abortion clinic. I didn't know anybody who'd been there. I wrote it in the first person, and I presented it as an autobiographical essay. And at the end of class, and Paul Briand, this was high tech back in the day, he used to use the overhead projector. So he would take your essay and then project it on a screen. So, I mean, if you didn't think about those commas, you know, they were going to be, you know, 12 inches on the screen. And he would go word by word with his wax pencil through everything you had written. It was one of the best, I mean, one of the most wonderful ways of teaching, and you would be sinking down in your seat as your words were up there. He did my piece, and at the end of the discussion, he said, McDermott, I want to see you after class. So I sheepishly went down, and I thought he was going to say nonfiction, you know? And he looked up, and he said, I got bad news for you, kid. You're a writer, and you'll never shake it. And that's when I knew. I knew I'd always known, but I didn't know until he said it. Hmm. That's what teachers do. Yeah.
Hi, this is for Alice McDermott. I have read your book, and I want to thank you for it. I thought it was extraordinary. I read something in a review that said you described the transformational moments of an ordinary life. And I was very taken by that. First of all, I thought it captured it beautifully. And secondly, I started to wonder if you knew what those moments were going to be before you started writing, or whether they presented themselves to you as you were writing about Marie's life. And because there, so much of what you wrote had a universal resonance. And I just wondered if you could comment about that.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. And Lauren, I'm sure that story's the same. I think you sort of start out with some sense that you think you know what you're doing, you know. But you quickly lose that sense as you start working sentence to sentence and learning what your novel is about and composing the novel, hearing it. And so in some ways you have to be your own first reader, and that means you have to leave yourself open to things that you hadn't expected, things that you hadn't planned on. And for me, writing about Marie, it felt like a tightrope walk through much of the early composition, because it was that sort of stubborn, she's not going to have anything terribly dramatic. I want to look at those transformative moments in an ordinary life that's not paid much attention to. So you put those kind of confines on the story, and then you start thinking. I mean, there were plenty of times, and I even have this written in some of my notebooks, you know, God, her husband had such an interesting time in the German prison camp. Maybe I should give him a chapter, you know. And her brother, I don't know, is he a closeted gay man? Is he, you know, is he really as spiritual as he seems? Maybe he should... And it was just really listening to her voice, and sort of after a while you kind of the late Seamus Heaney has a wonderful phrase that it's from one of his poems, but he also uses it as an injunction to poets, and he says, we must teach ourselves to walk on air against our better judgment. And a lot of composing, I think, fiction and, well, certainly poetry, is that having the courage to walk on air, say, I don't know anymore, I give myself over to whatever the language is bringing me to. And that's pretty much how how I had to proceed with Murray. Do you have that experience?
I feel I like the phrase walking on air against your better judgment, because I think it's against your better judgment to write anything sometimes. And I've never heard that line before, but I think a previous question asked about how you get the courage, and we didn't talk about that, but mm-hmm. that might be a good place to maybe take this, which is simply that I assume constantly that no one will read it, no one will be interested in it, and in that sort of desolate place, I find a lot of courage.
Yes,
it's just very easy for me to sit in my attic and write and pretend that it's only going to go as far as my old computer. And that is how I walk on air, you mm-hmm. know?
Yes, right.
Because I do it just to please myself. Yeah.
Well, unfortunately, we are out of time. So please join me in thanking Lauren Grotstein and Alice McDermott. Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.